but tomorrow morning I can do 7:30, 8 o'clock, 8:30.
This is Vinny DiQuattro. He runs Vinny D's, a barbershop in Providence.
Yeah, I can do 12:30, 1, 1:30. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow, 12:30. Okay.
As you can probably tell, Vinny's Italian. His shop is in Federal Hill. We're here to talk to him about the good old days when mob boss Raymond Patriarca ran the neighborhood. And because Mark needs a haircut.
Raymond used to get his haircut here, huh?
Yeah, once in a while, yes. And the sun used to come away once in a while.
Tell me about Federal Hill. You moved to Federal Hill how long ago?
1975. Federal Hill used to be awful Italian people.
Yeah.
It's sad, but years ago when Raymond used to be alive, he used to be more control, more bad. Since Rima died, lost controls.
There's a photo hanging on the wall. Vinny is a younger man with a gold medal around his neck. Also in the photo is another guy who we recognize.
Is this the award-winning haircut?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, tell the story about the gold medal, how you won the gold medal.
I won the gold medal. I take a contest, I take a model, and I cut hair on a stage. And my model used to be Jerry Tillinghast.
Yeah, that Jerry Tillinghast. Mob enforcer, Vietnam veteran, environmental inspector, and hair model.
Vinny's barbershop was right up the street from the one. So three times a week I would go get my beard trimmed. He said one day, he says, we've got a contest going. He says, why don't you be the model? I'm looking at the model, I said, what the fuck? You know, gay shit, you know what I mean? But I says, what do you mean? He said, yeah, model, cut your hair and, you know. I said, really? He said, yeah.
So Jerry and Vinny drove the 50 miles north to the contest in Boston. At the contest, there were 30 barbers, each with their own hair models.
The part that he didn't tell me, he says, we're going to have to sit still now. You can't move for a few hours. I said, what? And I says, all right, I think I got this. I did. Which I did, I was surprised.
I cut his hair and I waited to 10 o'clock but to wait for the prize. I said, Jerry, people don't have no chance, I don't think. But wait. They call it the third prize, they call it the second prize. I said, Jerry, let's go home because it's... But then they call mine the first prize and then I'm so happy.
Vinny told us another story about how, one day, Jerry came in with a friend named George Basmasian. Vinny gave them both a haircut, they chatted, and then, Vinny said, the next morning, he heard on the radio that George Basmasian was found dead, his body riddled with bullets.
He told me that the night that...
You want the song?
Yeah. And if you don't want to answer, you don't have to answer. But he told me the night that Basmasian was killed, you guys got your hair cut. And that you guys were there together and...
Yeah.
Yeah. He was your friend.
Yes, he was.
A lot of people were my friends that had passed away suddenly.
But in the case of this friend, Rhode Island State Police say that Jerry caused his passing. That not long after that haircut, Jerry Tillinghast murdered George Basmasian.
When we last left Jerry, he'd just beaten a rap in the bonded vault heist. On today's episode, The Code, to force Jerry to make a choice between his organized crime family and his actual family. I'm Mark Smerling.
And I'm Zach Stewart Pontier. Welcome to Crime Town.
I'm looking over, so where the fuck's my brother, Harold? So I go out back, he's got a shotgun and his eyes are as big as yo-yos and his fucking face is pale. I said, give me that fucking thing. I said, get the fuck out of here.
Organized crime is given too much credit. They're merchants of fear, and if you succumb to their fear, They own you.
Well, I never asked Mr. Tillinghast what happened. I didn't want to know. It didn't matter to me. I don't care. You follow me?
Why'd you do that?
It was my brother, because he would have got hurt. Because I know whatever it was they were going to do, and I'm not going to go into it, he didn't have it. He wasn't that made up like that. Worst decision I ever made in my life. What are you going to do?
It's November 30th, 1978, and State Police Detective Vincent Vespia is tailing George Basmasian the night he's murdered.
We were following Basmasian at the time he was killed. We think that they're going to pull a job, but we didn't think it was going to be a hit.
You met Vespia in episode one. He was a friend of Buddy Cianci's. According to court documents, the night of November 30th, Vespia and the rest of the surveillance team follow Basmasian to Michael's Lounge, a nightclub on the edge of Federal Hill. Also there is Jerry Tillinghast. Jerry's wearing a dark jacket with gold lettering on the back that reads Brass Rail, the name of a strip club. At 7:21, Vespia watches Jerry make a call from a phone booth. For a while, Jerry paces on the sidewalk in front of Michael's Lounge. Back and forth, back and forth. A couple minutes later, Jerry and Basmasian leave the lounge and get into Basmasian's car. Vespia follows them. He tracks them to a bowling alley where they switch into a different car, a stolen 1974 yellow Mercury. It's almost 9 p.m.
I was behind the car. It was Basmasian in the back seat. And two Tillinghasts in the front seat.
Harold. And Jerry.
Jerry was driving the car. It was a stolen car. Harold had stolen it earlier.
You remember Jerry's older brother, Harold, from episode two. He was the one standing behind the Peter Pan diner holding a shotgun the night that Mousy Rotondo was killed. Jerry made a choice that night. He took the shotgun from Harold, saving his brother from doing something he might regret. But now, Vespia saw the two of them in the stolen Mercury with George Basmasian.
And I started following them. Now I'm all alone.
Yeah, but do you have a car at 122 Homestead?
I got the CR-123 up here.
I'm calling for some help. I got him, you know, here. You know, we're heading this way, we're on this road. So I clearly see three people in the car. But I don't want to be made, and I'm, you know, doing all my maneuvers not to get made. So we get to an intersection of near the airport, and I'm three or four car lengths back.
For a moment, as the Mercury turns a corner, it disappears behind a fence. Just for a moment. But then, Vespia catches sight of it again, and he notices that something's changed.
Now I'm looking in the car, and I only see two people. Two Tillinghast brothers in the front seat. So I said, oh, shit, how did he get out of the car? I mean, I'm talking to myself. We came off 95, we're on an exit ramp. Where is he?
Vespia pulls back, worried about being made. He loses sight of the car. Then he begins to crisscross the area, trying to find it again. It's 9:20 p.m.
So I spot the car. The Tillinghasts are gone.
The Mercury sits abandoned in a parking lot near the airport. Vespia gets out of his unmarked car and walks across the lot.
The car is steaming up on the inside, you know? Open the car door. Basmasian's in the back seat with 9 bullet holes in him. I didn't count them at the time, but it turned out to be 9 bullet holes. So he's dead. Now I know why I didn't see him, you know.
The surveillance team convenes at the crime scene. Blood is still gushing from a huge wound in Basmasian's head. The medical examiner later concluded that Basmajian had been shot 9 times. All 9 shots were fired from the passenger seat from the same .38 caliber revolver. Think about this gruesome detail. .38 caliber revolvers only hold 5 or 6 bullets, which means the gunman fired 3 times into Basmajian's torso, reloaded, and then shot him 6 times in the face. Detective Vespia and an FBI agent go looking for the Tillinghast brothers and find them back at Michael's lounge, where they started the night. Vespia gets there around 9:55. He walks in and sees Jerry sitting at a table in the back.
Well, we were sitting in Michael's lounge, talking. I was in and out like every 15, 20 minutes, or whatever the case might have been. And in comes Vinny Vespia and an FBI guy. They come right over to me, push the table over and all that. And they told me, says, Jerry, get up, you're under arrest. I said, for what?
So I just went in there, threw the tables away, just grabbed onto them, you know, put them against the wall. Arrested them for murder, you know. As luck would have it, the jacket that Jerry had was splattered with blood. And whose blood was it? Basmajian's.
It was a slam dunk. Vespia saw Jerry and Harold with Basmajian in a stolen car. He followed them and found Basmajian's bullet-ridden body. And to make things even more certain, he found Basmajian's blood on Jerry's jacket. But Jerry said he was innocent. He and George Basmajian were friends.
And you and George were friends at some level.
We were.
Yeah, what was he like?
Well, George, he was a tough kid.
Yeah.
Tough kid. We'd go out, we'd have a few drinks, we'd gotten a lot of fights together.
So who was George Basmajian? Well, he was an outsider, an Armenian, hanging out with all these Italian and Irish wise guys, trying to prove his toughness. But he wanted to be big time, like Jerry.
He liked to be around high-profile people,
yeah.
You know. He had a self-dream to aspire to that, you know. I used to tell him it's not all what it's cracked up to be, brother,
yeah.
You know. He had a beautiful wife and daughter and family. I felt really bad for them when it all went down.
Why was Basmajian murdered? According to police, it was all about the mob's code. A code that demanded loyalty above everything else. A code that required Jerry to kill his friend. Jerry and Basmajian were suspects in several mob hits. A drug smuggler thrown out the 23rd story window of a hotel in Midtown Manhattan. A dealer strangled with piano wire and stuffed into a sleeping bag in Massachusetts. And Basmajian liked to brag, run his mouth. According to the code, people who talk too much have to go. It's a code that Jerry still lives by. He won't say if he was in the Mercury that night, but he will talk about what happened after his arrest. You see, outside Michael's lounge, his brother Harold was arrested too.
They took me outside. And Vinny Vespia says, no, wait a minute, we need one more. My brother opened the door, stuck his head out, said, where you taking my brother? I said, take him too. And that's how Harold got arrested.
Why did he take your brother?
Because he said we needed one more. He thought that my brother was with us in the car. So he said, take him too. He didn't come in and say, we're looking for Harold and Jerry. You know what I'm saying?
Here's the thing. A lot of people in Michael's lounge that night said Harold had never left the bar, that he spent the whole evening there, drinking, eating pizza, and watching Mork and Mindy. One of those people happened to be Paul DeMeo, Jerry's longtime lawyer, whose office was just down the block from Michael's.
November 30th, 1978. I walked down the street, a place called Michael's Lounge, and I see Jerry's car out in front. So I walk in, Hey, where's Jerry? Harold goes, he was just here. All right, so we sit down. Michael, me, and Harold sitting there.
According to DeMeo, he was with Harold at Michael's lounge the entire evening. He says there's no way Harold could have been involved in Basmasian's murder. Now, you might expect him to say that about Jerry, his longtime client, but that's not what he's saying. He's only talking about Harold.
Sometime after 9, Jerry sits down. My back was to the door, and I do not know if he was in the place. He probably wasn't. It was pretty small. Should be able to see him. And sat down next to us. Maybe 10 minutes after that, in comes Vinny Vespi and Phil Riley, FBI guy. And they grab Jerry. So I'm not going to get involved in this. What is this about? The murder. You know, I stay away from that kind of stuff. You know, okay, fine. Do what you got to do. And Harold is always nosy, and he's sitting there saying, I want to go find out what's happened. Sit down, Harold. Sit there. Do not get up. Well, what does he do? He gets up. I find out the time of the murder is a little after 9. Harold was not there. Absolutely not there. And I'm not going to lie to anybody. Certainly in a murder, when it comes to my license and what I do for a living, he was not there. I don't know who it was. I don't even know if Jerry was there, but the evidence seemed to be pretty strong that he was. Jerry wouldn't take Harold on a jaywalking expedition. Never mind a murder. Not that Jerry would commit a murder. I don't know that. Following?
We went down to the station and everything like that. They kept pulling him out, pulling me out. They were playing good cop, bad cop. You know, come on. So anyway, I said, listen, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't want to be back here. Don't be bothering me. There's nothing to say. You know? And I used to tell them, I said, we'll see you in the arena. That's what I used to call the courtroom.
Coming up after the break, we'll see you in the arena. Welcome back. 7 months after George Basmasian was found dead in the backseat of a stolen Mercury, the state of Rhode Island versus Gerald and Harold Tillinghast began. Here's what the Providence Journal said at the time. One brother, Jerry, is 3 years younger, but taller, bigger, and more outgoing. He's the man who many people fear, the man who had beaten the rap more than once, the man who went free after the bonded vault. The other brother, Harold, is the quiet one, the fey one, the man his lawyer called a character, the man who, one day, lifted his shirt to show the press gallery the Pink Panther tattooed on his stomach. Jerry says Harold had always been different, even as a kid.
He was a character. I remember Harold would always go out and he'd play with the girls. So, my mother got mad at him one day. She put a dress on him, straight up. Send him out like that, thinking she'd, you know, deal with some boys, hang with some boys too, and stuff like that. And didn't faze him a bit. He went right out there with the dress. It was funny. Funny as a bastard, yeah.
Was he your favorite brother?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah, we did everything together.
And that was the question facing the jury. Did Jerry and Harold murder George Basmasian together? The prosecution relied on the testimony of the surveillance team that followed Basmasian the night he was murdered, Detective Vincent Vespia and FBI agent Phil Riley. The defense tried to make Vespia look like he was out to get Jerry from the beginning. For example, when Vespia found Basmasian's body, he never checked to see if he was alive, as procedure required. And when Jerry's defense team asked why, Vespia said,
well, look, I've investigated maybe 5 murders that I believe he effected, and he didn't leave any of those people alive. So I took a calculated risk that Basmasian was dead. I said, and you know something, I was right. He only had 9 fucking bullets in his head, you know.
The defense argued that Harold hadn't been in the Mercury. And several witnesses testified that he was at Michael's lounge the entire night. During cross-examination, FBI agent Riley admitted that he saw Harold in the Mercury only in profile for just a few seconds. and he couldn't identify Harold's clothes or say whether or not he had a mustache. But Vespia was more certain.
He said Harold wasn't there.
Who was there? I saw Harold.
But Jerry was also certain.
Forget me.
Right.
I'm going to claim innocence anyway, right. No matter what, if I did or I didn't do it. There's no doubt in my mind, every cop that was involved, every judge, every prosecutor that came across that case knew he was innocent. The way the evidence was going, the way they had it going, I swear to God, I thought it was going to be a split decision. It means one guilty, one not guilty.
On August 11th, 1979, the verdict came back from a Providence Journal article that day. At about 2:20 p.m., the Tillinghasts were led into the courtroom in handcuffs. Harold looked grim, but Gerald smiled at his friends and relatives in the gallery. The brothers exchanged brief comments with their lawyers and shook hands with each other for good luck just before the jury entered the room a minute later. The Tillinghasts sat immobile, their faces grim, as the verdict was announced. Jerry and Harold were both found guilty of murder and sentenced to life in prison.
It was a war. We considered it a war against organized crime. It was us against them.
Again, Detective Vincent Vespia.
In those days, prior to court decisions and best practices that we talk about nowadays, because it was a crusade, we did some things that probably would be frowned upon legally today. But why did we do it? Because it was the way to win the battle.
What was it like when they read the verdict? Can you explain what that felt like?
Well, you're upset, you don't like it, but you try to maintain composure. I know Harold was sick. I was sick about it.
Think about this. If the jury was wrong about Harold, like Jerry says, that means there was someone else in the Mercury that night. Another guy, in the passenger seat, who pulled that trigger 9 times. And if the jury was right about Jerry, then he could have saved his brother by giving up that other person. But guys like Jerry don't do that. Flipping on another wise guy would have meant breaking the code. So Jerry and Harold both headed to Rhode Island's Adult Correctional Institutions, or ACI.
See, the first 5 years that I was in that bit, I was in denial and not the river in Egypt.
Yeah.
Trust me. I didn't give a fuck. I'd assault an officer as well as an inmate, anybody. I didn't care. I was bitter, you know, because of my brother.
Harold Tillinghast spent more than 2 decades in prison. Again, attorney Paul DeMeo.
Every year Harold went up for parole, I'd go up and say to the parole board, I'm here for the, you know, rehabilitation. He doesn't need it. He didn't do it, all right? So finally let him out after about 25 years. He's definitely innocent of that.
Harold's health declined. He had advanced heart disease and was taking medication. But toward the end of his sentence, when he was out on parole, his condition took a turn for the worse.
He got out. He wanted to go to the mall, the Providence Mall, to buy some jeans. My sister didn't want him to go out. She wanted him to stay home, but he was determined he wanted to go. And when he got right in front of Filene's, I think it was Filene's, he had the heart attack. And we talk about him all the time. You know, my theory is this. As long as you talk about them, they're in your heart and they're alive. We keep them alive. If you don't talk about anybody anymore, eventually it passes.
The world changed while Jerry was behind bars. As the 70s stretched into the 80s, the federal government was cracking down on organized crime. Prison sentences were getting longer, and more mob guys started to rat, to flip. The code that Jerry sacrificed his brother for suddenly didn't mean as much.
Bad thing is when you grow up with a code,
and you stick to it, then you see people that invented the code go the other way. You know, pisses you off.
And then, in 2007, after almost 30 years in prison, Jerry got out.
Mr. Tillinghast, can you tell us what you're thinking now? Fresh air?
I just wanted to get in the car and go home and enjoy the moment.
State prosecutors and the state police say Jerry Tillinghast is one of Rhode Island's most notorious mob murderers.
He was a feared street enforcer. Again, hopefully prison has mellowed him. The reports that we have that he is.
Mellow now, maybe, but a convicted murderer, always.
Today, Jerry Tillinghast is 70 years old. He lives in a nice suburban house on the outskirts of Providence. He became a Wiccan in prison, and there are books about magic on the shelves. He spends his time playing Dungeons and Dragons. He has a cat. And he says he no longer blames the cops for anything. Not for arresting Harold back in 1978, and not for putting both of them away for decades.
Life's too short to hold grudges.
Yeah, of course.
You know, listen, they do what they gotta do. I don't hold grudges against Vinny or anybody. They're doing their job. If I put myself in a position to where I have to worry about the law, that's on me. Choices.
I made a choice. My favorite word is choices. It should be everybody's in this fucking world. You make it, you own it. You reap the benefits, suffer the consequences. You made the choice. Be man enough or woman enough to take the pain as well as the gain.
Hey listeners, we're taking the next few weeks off for the holidays and to work on the rest of the season. But we'll be back on January 22nd with much more from Providence, Rhode Island and this season of Crime Town.
Crime Town is me, Zach Stewart Pontier, and Mark Smerling. We're produced by Drew Nellis, Austin Mitchell, and Mike Plunkett, with additional production by Laura Sim. We are edited by Alex Bloomberg and Caitlin Kenny. Fact-checking by Mick Rouse. This episode of Crime Town was mixed, sound designed, and scored by Matthew Bowl. Our title track is Run to Your Mama by Goat. Our credit music this week is Into the Gray by Vanessa Blay. Original music by John Cusiak, John Ivins, Edwin, and Beanart. Our ad music is by Matthew Bowl. Additional sound design by Ted Robinson at Silver Sound. Additional mixing by Martin Peralta and Enoch Kim. Our digital editor is Kate Parkinson Morgan. Our design director is Ale Lariu. Alex Bloomberg is the podfather. But Alex, we wouldn't take you on a jaywalking expedition. This season of Crime Town is dedicated to the memory of Zachary Malinowski. We miss you, Bill. Shout out to Matt O'Connor for teaching us that the ACI is plural. Thanks to the Providence Journal, WPRI, Julia Haymans, Emily Wiedemann, Tim White, Dan Barry, Lisa Newby, Mary Murphy, Greg Malazzi, and everyone who shared their stories with us. For a full list of credits, visit our website at crimetownshow.com. And you can find us on Twitter at Crimetown and on Facebook and Instagram at Crimetown Show. And if you're enjoying Crime Town, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps others find out about the show. Thanks. Providence is a special place, and we're honored to tell a part of its story. See you in a couple weeks.
Was you guys drinking coffee?
Yeah, I'm drinking coffee.
Did you get sweet and low?
Give him a spoon. A spoon you can do.
Okay. Well, no, this will be all right. Whew, you're tough. You're not a good host, I gotta tell you.
Not bad, though. No?
That's salt.
Is that salt?
It's really... It's salt.
Guys, but who puts salt in this kind of thing?
You guys want to leave? This is going to be messy. I'm telling you. There's going to be a lot of blood here in a minute. You guys want to leave?